Must stop promptly. Would you join me in welcoming our speaker tonight, please, Barry?
Okay. It's so low. It's supposed to be like that? No? Yeah? Great. Okay. Hello, I'm Barry. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Barry.
Thank you so much for asking me to speak. Super grateful to be here and get the opportunity to be of service tonight, especially in this blizzard. I'm visiting from New York. I don't live here anymore. I used to, so that's why I know quite a few people here. It's great to see everyone. So I'm, you know, cabin fever with the family. Fun. But it's good. You know, I'm forced to be around them, which is good. It's helping me to put them before me. Because usually I would blow into town and say, like, can you get this milk for me? Can I borrow the car? I need to go here. Da, 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 da. So now I'm kind of like going, okay, they're here. I'm calling people and saying I'm going crazy. And they're saying, you know, see what you can do around the house. Help out. Ask mom if she needs help, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm doing that, and it's helping me stay sober and sane today. So I'm very grateful for that. And I wouldn't have that if it wasn't for this program. So that's my clock. Okay. And also in New York, my home group is the Atlantic Group. And if any of you are traveling there, I would love to help you get to a meeting. So come up to me afterward and get my number. I would love to help you because I love to just be available for people. Because when I travel, it means so much to have people take me to meetings or lead me to the right place so I don't feel alone in that state, you know, or that town, wherever I am. So definitely come up to me afterward if you'll be traveling there. I can help you get to meetings. And let's see, my sobriety date is July 31st, 1998. And I don't know why I say that. It's just a habit of saying that. And I'm told to tell my story. So what happened, or what it was like, what happened, and what I'm like now. So let's see. I don't come from a family of immediate alcoholics, but I do have it in the gene pool. I just found that out, in fact. I always thought that I didn't have that, and my mom said that, in fact, I did. So that makes me feel a little better because I used to obsess on that and be, oh, you know, maybe I'm not an alcoholic, and it's not in my gene pool, la, la, la. And in fact, it is. So I can say that now. Yay. The other thing is, though, is that the disease strikes anyone. You know, and I know that. It's like eventually we do cross that line where we will be drinking like alcoholics, you know, if we are, in fact, alcoholics. And so I had my first drink when I was about 14, and it was just experimental, and I didn't really like it, but I did like it because I felt different. So I made sure that I drank until I did like it, and that made me into an alcoholic. Right out of the gates, I suffered consequences. Like I said, it was experimental, but that also led to other things. The alcohol led to, you know, a lot of drugs, too. And I know this is an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, and I'll stick on that topic. But I do have the disease of alcoholism, and it encompasses all of that for me. And I can't tell my story without mentioning it, so I do have to mention that. So I went ahead and continued drinking. Just like I said, right out of the gates, I suffered consequences. I was a good kid. You know, I was getting decent grades. I was in track and field. I was, you know, happy. And I started the alcohol, and that became my primary purpose. And it was just about getting more and getting drunker and getting more and getting drunker and finding people that were, you know, doing the same thing that I was or less than I, you know, worse than I was so that I could look better. And I found those people, and I did that, and I just kept on going down. And I started suffering consequences like, you know, juvenile delinquent centers, lockup, stealing clothes, selling them for money, getting suspended from school, going to court school, having friends come into my parents' house that would steal their things, they therefore put a bolt lock on their bedroom, you know. So I wasn't hanging out with, you know, pillars of society. And from that point on, the heat started to get on me, and I was getting in trouble with the law and things like this. And so I was having to do urine analysis and things like this. And again, I was going to any lengths to stay drunk. So I would use other people's urine and give it to them. And I just wasn't ready to quit. I mean, it just didn't matter. It was just more of a challenge for me to work around the system. And so I did that because I needed to feed this addiction, this alcoholism that I had. And so just fast forwarding, the heat started to get on me too much. So I began to get sober for other people. And it didn't work. And at age 18, I had an opportunity to go to Europe. I had a great job, and it was over there. And I went to Europe. And over there, they didn't have a drinking age. Well, it was 18. And so I could throw out the fake IDs and just go for it. And I went for it. And again, just more consequences. I found the wrong people. The other thing is that my job was taking off. So I was in the fashion industry. I was a model, and I started at 18, and it was going really well, and I was going down. So here I had all these pictures and sort of like, you know, accolades telling me that you're doing fine, and I was just a mess. I was a dead soul, didn't know myself at all, doing things I said I would never do, etc. 2 years of Europe, and then I said, okay, I'm going to go to New York. So I came to New York, and it just got worse. And I'm just going to fast forward to what my story looked like about the last 4 years of my active alcoholism. I got to New York, and I just continued doing the same thing. And this whole time, you know, I was super antisocial. I had one boyfriend, and that's all that I wanted to be around. I could make it to the jobs, but then right after the jobs, I would just get loaded. And it was just a very sad existence. And then so at age 24, again, I needed to escape people that were on my back. So I started getting sober for other people one more time. And from the age of 24 to 28, I was in and outside of psych wards. I went to Bellevue, St. Vincent. This is all in New York. Cornell Medical Center. I started going to Minnesota, Hazelden twice, Silver Hills in Connecticut, all different kinds of treatment centers. And, you know, I remember being in my apartment. Again, I didn't understand. It says in the book that we have a disease and that we're powerless. And I completely know that today. I mean, I wanted to quit so bad, but I just couldn't. I had no idea why I could not quit. And I mean, I remember I had big books from the treatment centers in my house. And I would open them up and be like, save me, you know. And I remember one has bite marks on it, literally. I was totally insane. And towards the end, you know, I was just completely powerless. And towards that last 4 years, you know, I would just began to hurt myself. I remember banging my head up against the wall. I would punch things, just rageful. And the banging against the head against the wall was to let people in the room know that I'm crazy and they need to do what I'm saying, because if not, I'm going to go more crazy. You know, just going to any lengths like that. And it was strange, too, because the career was still sort of doing well. And I remember I was in a psych ward, St. Vincent's, for about 2 weeks in a lockdown unit, and the text in there pinned up a picture of me that was, they pinned up a picture of me while I was in the psych ward. And this was, you know, pretty embarrassing. So that was that. Let's see. Fast forwarding to, as a result of this disease, I thought it would be a good idea to move into a house where they were dealing crack and running an escort service out of. So I lived there for 10 months. And it started to dwindle down to where I couldn't even work. All I could do is get up and drink and participate in my disease. That's all I could do. So I said, well, let me go to the source. And so I went to the source. And even I was too crazy for those people. I began to shave my head. I know looking at me today, it doesn't seem like these things are possible, but it made me completely mentally ill. And I do believe that I have a mental illness. So even they told me to get out. So push come to shove, and within all of that, I also I OD'd. I was found about 3 minutes from death. I was turning blue in a short stay hotel in New York. I don't know the guy that ran out and told the front desk and, you know, left me there. He's an angel, and I wish I could find him today to thank him. He is truly an angel. And so I woke up in St. Vincent's Hospital, and again, I had to appease people and let them know that I'm getting sober for them, because by this time I had AA friends, and I had people in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous in New York, but I wasn't working a strong program. I was just going when it was convenient for me. I was just so immature. I was still a 14-year-old, 12-year-old, let's say, walking around in a 28-year-old's body. It was really pretty pathetic. So I went to, I said to them after the psych, not the psych ward, but the OD, I said, I got to get out of this hospital. And, you know, so I left early. And I went to my friend's house who was in AA, and, you know, they're all scared of me, like, oh, what you going to do? And I just calmed them down. I said, let's just drop me off at a rehab. Everything's going to be fine. So I went to a rehab again, left that, came back to my house, didn't know why I couldn't stop, and I just began drinking again. Same thing happened. By the grace of God, I have a family today that loves me so much that intervened on me. And they came and intervened on me, and it wasn't just a, you know, let's sit around a circle, we think you should get help. It was a, you're going to the psych ward, to another lockdown unit, and we're not going to watch you kill yourself. By the grace of God, I had that family today. And so I went ahead and went to the psych ward, and I started my journey. And by the grace of God, I had a social worker there who, her name is Carolyn Sparrow, who I also would like to find and thank. She wouldn't let me go on smoke walks. She would not let me get out after the 2 weeks. She said, no, 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 you're going to have to go to another place. And I'm glad she did, because I still had the craving. I still had the craving to drink after all of that. It was still in me. Because I hadn't done any of this work, you know. I mean, you put it down and you're still left with that, the spiritual malady. This is a spiritual illness, spiritual illness. Yeah, we have it. We suffer from our in our mind, in our body, but it is spiritual. And so so I agreed to Carol Sparrow, my social worker, and I said, fine, I'll go to another place. I went to this place in Arizona, and I think so I flew there, and at that point I could have run on the way from the psych ward to the airport, but for some reason I didn't. And I got to the airport, and the place, and the little itty bit of willingness that I had to go to that place, and also divine intervention swept in, came in. And I got there, and I said, gosh, I have nothing to lose, you know. I have nothing to lose by giving this my all. And so I started doing that, and for once, I didn't do it my way. You know, I really submitted to what they were telling me to do. And something came over me, and I just made a turn, and I utilized those tools that were at my feet there. I utilized this environment for me to do what they were trying to do with me, which is get me to talk, basically, and get me to feel, basically, and be honest, and, you know, work out all my dumb little alcoholic games there at the place. And I said, wow, this is a great opportunity. Let me just do this. And also I had support of others. A lot of times in those places, just like, you know, recovering groups, you can have, it's healthy people feed off of healthy people. Let me just put it that way. And by the grace of God, I had a healthy group with me in that place. And so I felt encouraged, you know, and that's what I need today. It's why part of the reason I come to meetings. So I went... I'm losing my train of thought. Okay. So from there, I went to another place, another four-month place. And at that place, they said, Barry, you need to go to an AA meeting every day. You need to get a sponsor, and you need to work the steps. So I did that in conjunction with this treatment stuff, and that started to lay a foundation for me. And because I became very honest, and I did it all their way, and I stopped doing it my way. And I have to say the biggest key for me was I just became very honest. And, you know, I stopped holding things in. I talked instead of, you know, harbor things and let it build and eventually kill me, which is what it will do today, too. So there I was, and that was in Arizona, and I started to lay a foundation for myself. And, I got a sponsor right away. I didn't even hesitate. I just got this first woman that I heard speaking, and she happened to be talking about the steps, and she took me through the steps, and I did everything that they said to do. I did pretty much all the suggestions, and I started to get freedom, and I have to tell you that the obsession to drink was completely removed, completely removed. I had a few cravings, and at that point, I was so afraid of this disease, I just called people, and they went away, and I said a simple prayer, God, will you please remove this craving from me right now? And he does, and he did, and I still do that today. I say, will you please remove any thought for any mind or mood-altering substance? Please just remove it from me, because this disease is so powerful, and again, I'm extremely afraid of it. And I'm only an arm length away from a drink today, you know. I'm not immune from anything here. And so I'm just going to fast forward right into my recovery and what that has looked like. Arizona was about 3 years, and I got into a relationship when I had 8 months of sobriety, and he was sober. He had a little less time than me, and I stayed sober from that, and I know they say not to get into relationships and all of that, but, you know, what I did is I put my recovery first, and I made sure I had girlfriends. That's what I did. I could not, you know, hole up with the guy, you know, and, like, not have a support team. I just couldn't do that. I was so afraid of this disease. And I know that that's what saved me, is I put that first. And then we broke up, and I moved to Oregon, actually. And I came here, and I was a mess, my God, because of the breakup. And I met Barb, and she helped me a lot. And I met a lot of people here that helped me a lot. And I got through that. And it was in Oregon, actually, where I had 5 years of sobriety. And I really hit a wall in sobriety, and I just hated it. I hated AA. I hated all of you. and which is opposite of today. Today I want what you have. That's why I'm here, you know. And so I went to Chris, actually, and I said, you know what? I'm depressed. I hate AA. What would you do? You know, I'm not going to sit here in this muck. I can't. I can't afford to. I can't afford to. I have a disease that wants to kill me. So I need to get out of it, and I need to get into a solution. So I went to someone that I respected, and Chris gave me a solution out of the big book, and it included prayer and meditation. And the thing is, I didn't have a home group. And he said, do you have a home group? I said, no. He said, do you have sponsees? I don't think I did at the time. And so he just catapulted me and sort of jump-started my program into being of service. And he said, great, come to this meeting with me. And right when I got there, he said, go talk to the new girl. And I was so in my depression that I thought I had nothing to give. You know, 5 years of sobriety, at 20 days, 5 days of sobriety, you have something to give. You know, you have one more day than the new guy. And so that was just my ego and my depression getting in the way. And also my lack of willingness, you know, my lack of faith. And so I took this direction, and I started to see a shift. And I had done the 12 steps at this point, and he said to me, when's your last inventory? And I had to do a little mini 4-step and you know, get up to date on that. And then I also had to start working a 6 and 7-step. That's something I had never done well, you know. In the big book, it's kind of vague, the way it's written out in the big book. In fact, we have one line about it in the big book. And, you know, we have the 12 and 12, which is great. It expands a bit. A lot. And so I just wasn't, you know, here I had all my defects, like fear, low self-esteem, low self-worth. You know, those are the main players, dishonesty. And I had to start actually implementing 6 and 7, you know, recognizing in 6 that I have them, and then 7, working with God to get rid of them, you know, and working the 7-step prayer, which is in 12, the 12 and 12. And so I started having, you know, this new tool in my toolbox, and I was able to work that. You know, and I really started getting relief from that. Really. And today I need to use that too. I mean, I was just telling Aaron that I woke up 2 days ago hating everyone, you know, just hating people. And I was like, what's going on? You know, so I had to take pen to paper and just start writing. I had to just get it out of me, because I'm staying at my mom's and my stepdad's, and that's fertile ground for me to act out. Fertile. And I don't want to do it. I don't want to go make amends. No, I don't want to do it. So I got to, like, step back, calm down, get with God. And for me, a lot of times, I can't even pray or meditate. I just put pen to paper. I just have to get it out. And then at that time, I can maybe meditate and step back and pray or read. So but I just point that out, because this stuff is a continuation. This thing is a complete continuation. So that was at the practice of what's in this book and working this. And it evolves, you know, more is revealed. How am I on time? Like, okay. So, let's see. I get to pick a topic at 5 minutes. That's good. So that was at 5 years, and I started to get some freedom. And then my work, I was still modeling and still am, and it kept taking me to New York, and I was traveling and going back and forth. And I said, wow, I probably should go back there and make some more money while I can. Make it, you know, while I'm still young. so I went back there 3 years ago, and It took me like 2 years to desensitize myself because of all the buildings and the cement. I had gotten so used to Oregon and the sunsets and the, well, when we, you know, when it's sunny, it's gorgeous here. But I had gotten so used to all of that. And so it took me about, I'm telling you, a year and a half, 2 years to desensitize. But I was still using my sponsor here in Oregon, Anne, and she was like, she just gave me hardcore directions. She said, Barry, pick a home group, get a commitment, sign up, blah, 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 blah. So I took all her direction, and I did that, and I didn't hesitate too much, which was easy to do in that city because I had to find the right meeting and the right thing, and it had to be convenient to my house. And so I did that for a little while, and now I'm plugged in, and I feel good there, and I got a sponsor there and stuff. And so that's what's going on with that. You know, and while I'm here, like, I have sponsees, and they call me, and I just love them so much because they remind me what my purpose is today, what my purpose is on this planet. What my favorite thing is to get them sponsoring people. I cannot wait until they sponsor people. Because I'm, you know, they've got to give this away. Just like I'm giving it to them, they need to give it away. And also, they won't be so crazy. So... So, you know, today, what I do for my program is I go to meetings. You know, when I'm really crazy, I try to go to more meetings. I have a home group. I have two service commitments, sponsees. I have a sponsor. I travel a lot, and I have to really pray about how I'm going to get creative and get to meetings. With that, you know, I hem and haw about the cab rides, $40. But I just bring it back to, I could be dead. This thing is to save my life. You know, I could be dead. And I always feel better once I connect and plug into the source, which is AA. You know, I plug into the source. And I've learned from people in the program, and I can't say enough for the people that have gone before me and helped me, and my sponsors, my alcoholic friends, you know, people that have gone before me who I can call at any time of night, leave the weirdest message ever, you know, I can get help from them. And also they're an example for me. You know, I've learned in AA. AA is such a teaching ground for me. It's taught me everything. It's given me my self-esteem back. You know, it's taught me to sit in the front, you know, be in the middle, not on the out. My default is so insecure. I back away from everything. I stay on the outside. And it's just low, you know, it's insecurity. So with the tools of this program of, you know, acting as if, showing up no matter what, you know, suiting up and showing up, not acting on feelings, you know, just doing what I need to do, which is maintenance, you know. And, I mean, my mom made this comment, you know, she said this comment about meetings because she's not an alcoholic. And I had to explain to her, it just bothered me, you know. What I remember is what I've heard in this program, and my program is not negotiable. It is what it is, and it's not negotiable. I don't care who you are, what you are, it's just not negotiable. I don't have the luxury today. And why would I? This program gives me everything. It gave me my entire life back, you know. And just back to what I said about, you know, I can take my behavior that I have in this room, in a work environment, in a family environment, in an everything environment. And I need to keep it consistent. I need to keep it consistent. And, you know, welcome with 30 days. That's amazing. And no matter how you're feeling, you're in the right place. So, so happy that you're here. You know, in this program, it's, you know, go to people that you want what they have, that you respect. You know, I mean, I had to do that. Even, like, in New York today, it's easy for me to not, I have to reach out to people with the same amount of time as me or more. That's something I don't do enough because they scare me. I'm like, you know, but I need to do that. I need to do that. You know, I can't only reach out and try to help newcomers because I'll go insane. You know, I'll go insane. I need to get fed, too, in a way, you know. So that's one thing that I need to do. Because I can get intimidated easily, which is just my disease. It's stupid, you know. But I know that I'm wrapping up here. So I just want to, I read there is a solution before I got here, because I just wanted to put it in my head before I shared. And I just want to read a few things and then give you guys a topic. So in the chapter in the big book, there is a solution. It says, "We feel that elimination of our drinking is but a beginning. A much more important demonstration of our principles lies before us in our respective homes, occupations, and affairs." I needed to read that tonight because I'm home for the holidays. So I need to really concentrate on that. It says, "Our very lives as ex-problem drinkers depend upon our constant thought of others and how we may meet their needs." That's something I also need to be reminded of constantly. And then this, at a certain point in the drinking of every alcoholic, he passes into a state where the most powerful desire to stop drinking is of absolutely no avail. This tragic situation has already arrived in practically every case long before it is suspected. The fact is that most alcoholics, for reasons yet obscure, have lost the power of choice in drink. Our so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent. We are unable at certain times to bring into our consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. We are without defense against the first drink. And then what we already read at the beginning, you know, about our Creator entering our hearts. And that we only have two alternatives. One is to go on to the bitter end, blotting out the consciousness of our intolerable situation at best, and the other is to accept spiritual help. I mean, so that's what I know. What I know is I just need to keep it simple. Helping another alcoholic, or if there's not one around, another person will always get me out of a jam. No matter what, it'll always get me out of a jam. If I would just shift my thoughts to thinking about someone else, whether it's, you know, just looking at them in the eye and, like, shifting the conversation, how are you today? You know, how was your day? You know, if I can't, like, literally, you know, let them have my seat or dust their table or something, you know, I can, you know, shift it to that. And it always shifts. And the other thing is gratitude. You know, I get in depression easily. And so what I'll start, and I don't feel like praying. So what I'll do is I'll just start thanking God for the most basic things ever. And that completely shifts my brain. Completely shifts my brain. And sometimes I need to think of about 20 things before I start to feel a little teeny opening. You know, but I can just get to that foundation, that starting point. Instead of, help me, can I, can't I, help me. You know, I have to just start by thinking. And then I can sort of see a little bit and, you know, shift it around. So the topic will be service. Guys want to talk about service, it would be great. And my time is up, so thank you so much. And thank you, everyone.